dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we'll conclude Chapter 5, The World Under Control. From The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. In this chapter, Eisenstein has been looking at the various aspects of our lives in which what he calls the technological program of domination and control is manifest. The chapter began with the ideological justification for this control, the innate depravity of man, a being who will further his self-interest at the expense of others if not restrained by force. Control in general is justified in the name of protection of people from their fellows in order to eliminate suffering, as well as from suffering created by the unpredictability of the natural world. But as Eisenstein has repeatedly pointed out, the society that has resulted from these efforts has created unparalleled misery, both individually, collectively, and for the entire ecosphere. Last week, I read the sections that deal in large part with the breaking of the human spirit in childhood, the elimination of real play and the replacement of it with controlled activities that at a younger and younger age rob children of the creative exploration that free play provides. He also dealt with schooling, drawing many of his ideas from the work of John Taylor Gatto, which I've previously read on the show, that shows our institution of schooling to be designed to create human beings who will accept control as adults and not rebel against the stupid, meaningless, soul-destroying social roles our society provides. This week, the reading focuses on his analysis of law, medicine, psychiatry, and the question of suffering and health generally. His critique of the medical system is scathing, and his analyses of the causes of ill health are drawn from his perspective as one involved with traditional Chinese medicine. They may be challenging to some listeners because in the course of his discussion, he rejects as fatuous what is a central belief of our society and a central justification for the program of domination and control, that we can live happily ever after. Yet he is not inviting his readers to a masochistic existence, though some could make that interpretation. Throughout the reading, he's alluded to later chapters in the book, where new paradigms for human life and society will be introduced. That will begin in our readings next week, as we conclude with the first part of the book, designed to give us a thorough understanding of where we are and how we've gotten here. So let's continue with the conclusion of Chapter 5, The World Under Control, from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Life Under Contract. The tyranny of yes and no, the migration of life to a wholly domesticated realm, and the dwindling of the uncertain and undefined in favor of the expressly permitted and explicitly forbidden takes another form in laws, rules, and regulations. Here, the program of control manifests as a spreading legalism that infiltrates all aspects of modern life. In the ecological sphere, the shrinking of the wild is domestication, confinement, and the great indoors. In the personal sphere, it's the conquest of the child's spontaneity and creativity. In the social sphere, it is the codification of previously informal agreements, ethics, and mores. As legal scholar Paul Campos puts it, anyone who compares the legal domains of our society to those of the pre-modern state immediately becomes aware of a tremendous and ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space. Close quote. Our dependence on authority to delimit the realm of the permissible projects onto the collective level as the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play. Thanks to our schooling, we are accustomed to being told what is allowed, accustomed to authority determining right and wrong, and accustomed to coercive enforcement of these distinctions. Implicit in a world under control is that if something goes wrong, it must be someone's fault. Someone must bear legal responsibility. Someone must be punished, and I should be compensated. And so, children in authoritarian institutions such as schools resolve disputes by telling on each other, going to teacher, the source of authority. In religion, the same tendency manifests in the idea of God as a referee who will reward the just, punish the wicked, and make everything fair in the end. In law, this attitude motivates the burgeoning realm of the regulated, the ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space, and our endemic reliance on lawsuits to resolve disputes. The rule of law has become a necessity as other forms of social coordination have broken down with the dissolution of community. In olden times, informal social pressures were far more potent than they are today, because people depended on their neighbors to meet economic and social needs. The goodwill of the community was extremely important, and the consequences of social shunning severe. Today in America, there are few real communities to speak of, only neighborhoods, and the opinion of neighbors matters little. As long as I obey all the laws, who cares what the neighbors think? I'm safe from anything they might do. I don't need to buy things from them. I don't need them to watch out for my children. I don't use the things they make. I don't depend on them for recreation. The conversion of social capital into money means that just as with all the rest of life's necessities, we rely on remote strangers for dispute resolution. The local and personal has been replaced by the formal and remote. Suppose my son breaks my neighbor's window with a baseball. My neighbor asks me to pay for it. In the past, if I refused, the opinion of the whole neighborhood would turn against me. If I consistently behaved like that, I would find myself unable to get credit at the local grocer's, unable to receive emergency services from the local doctor, unable to get babysitting help when something happened. People depended on the favors and non-monetary reciprocation that we call neighborliness. In most places in America today, few of those mechanisms of social pressure still operate, and my neighbor has no choice but to sue me, resorting to the outright coercive force of a distant and impersonal authority. Impersonality is built into the very concept of law, which is supposed to be objective, rational, and impartial. Disputes are to be resolved not according to who knows who, not according to one's reputation in the community, not according to whom the judge likes, not according to emotional judgments of right and wrong, and not according to popular sentiment, but rather by the impartial application of legal reasoning. that disputes in general can and should be resolved according to logic and principle is a fundamental assumption springing from the Newtonian Cartesian worldview and modeling itself after axiomatic mathematics. In formal mathematics, we start with basic axioms, the equivalent of a constitution, and reason from those, adding new axioms, legislation, as necessary where the old ones fail to prove or disprove a proposition, resolve a new type of dispute. At the zenith of the age of reason in the early 20th century, David Hilbert enunciated the final goal of mathematics, a complete set of axioms from which all mathematical truth could be deduced. Though Hilbert's program crumbled with the work of Gödel and Turing in the 1930s, in the realm of law, we seem to think that any failure to rationally resolve the disputes of our day can and should be addressed with yet more laws. The end result would be a Hilbertian complete set of principles by which the legality of any act could be determined through unassailable logic. Then the ambiguity of human interaction would be gone. We would have in human relationship the same certainty that physicists have sought for centuries in their quest for a complete universal law, a theory of everything, in which everything would be of well-defined legal standing. Every act would be either legal or illegal. Already, we are so thoroughly conditioned to a world under control that I suspect many people would not see this as an alarming statement. It might even be hard to conceive of any other status, just as it is hard to conceive of a piece of land just existing without being owned. Someone has to own it. It can't just be there. We find it easy to understand. Everything is legal unless expressly prohibited, or everything is illegal unless explicitly permitted, but not that some things simply have no legal status. In any realm, the regime of control demands the elimination of uncontrolled variables, the domestication of the wild. In the realm of law, the wild is the unregulated social space, and the variables represent uncertainty. Law represents the social reification of the technological program, whose goal is, as Campos puts it, quote, the final elimination of risk itself. He goes on to interpret the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play as a contemporary byproduct of the need to deal with the loss of any broadly held belief regarding the point of human existence, close quote. Intuitively, Campos has come close to a central theme of this book, which is that the compulsion to control the world arises out of an alienation which has shorn life of any meaning except the maximization of comfort, safety, and pleasure. Except it is more than a need to deal with a loss of belief that generates the urge to control. Control, rather, is the inevitable logical conclusion of our beliefs themselves. Here's an amusing example of the legalistic program to eliminate uncertainty. Some years ago, I read that the student code at a certain college was amended to require that each new step in erotic foreplay be preceded by the explicit consent of both parties, as in, may I kiss you? Yes. May I caress your breast? Yes, and so forth. No doubt this rule was written to clarify certain situations in which sexual consent was ambiguous, as in, just because I kissed him doesn't mean I gave him permission to grope me, close quote. The solution, define consent with even more rules. Forget the absurdity of the whole thing for a moment and consider the fundamental assumption that a sufficiently minute set of rules can resolve all ambiguity. It's the technological program again. One can imagine a case where the meaning of explicit consent comes into question. Is a sigh of passion enough? Does reciprocation of a caress need prior consent? What about uh-huh instead of yes? Where does the sigh end and uh-huh begin? No doubt we could create even finer distinctions to resolve these ambiguities, but there would be still more ambiguities created by the very attempt to define them away. The parallel with mathematics is uncanny. Gödel demolished Hilbert's program by proving that given any consistent axiomatic system of sufficient complexity, there will be true sentences in the formal language of that system that are unprovable from the axioms. The true sentence, or its negation, could be added as a new axiom, but no matter how many are added, there will always be yet other true statements unprovable from the expanded set of axioms. Similarly, no matter how fine the distinctions of law, there will always be situations that are not logically resolvable from the law. We can add new axioms, new laws, finer distinction, but still there would be logically irresolvable situations. Steeped as we are in the mindset of the technological program, the solution is nonetheless to always add on more laws, more regulations, in hopes of finally encompassing every possible situation within a legal framework, everything either expressly forbidden or explicitly permitted with no gray areas. The result is, as Campos puts it, the 100-page appellate court opinion, the 200-page, 500-footnote law review article, the 1,000-page statute, the 16,000-page set of administrative regulations. And yet, as the letter of the law swells in exactitude and scope, the spirit of the law withers away and its power to control human behavior diminishes. The extension of law into every corner of life is visible in the increasing pervasiveness of the contract. We enter into contracts all the time without even noticing it. Have you ever noticed fine print saying, quote, by purchasing this product you agree, ... close quote. At Penn State, by enrolling in the university, the student is legally consenting to abide by the regulations of the voluminous student handbook, and by enrolling in my class is agreeing to the syllabus, which is accorded the status of a contract between the student and the university. A contract is a legal agreement, one that is real in the eyes of the law. Here is the culmination of the confusion between label and object that representational language invites. The reality of an agreement depends on being written down, while consent devolves into a signature. What counts in an agreement? Not the unspoken understanding, nor its social context, but only what is in black and white, words on a page. Of course, the seeming objectivity of a law or contract is an illusion, since the words interpretation and enforcement, indeed, still depend on these more human factors. Expanding legalism rises out of the dissolution of community. Equally, it contributes to it. By relying on outside authority to adjudicate and impose a solution, we are relieved of the necessity of working things out among ourselves. You won't hear from me again, you'll hear from my lawyers. These were the last words a friend of mine heard from a business partner of many years. Another variation, tell it to the judge. Another consequence of social governance by lawsuit and threat of lawsuit is the further reduction of life into money that I discussed in Chapter 4. Damages are calculated in dollars, and it is through dollars that we redress the matters of betrayal of trust, negligence, pain and suffering, and all the other subjects of lawsuits. Generally speaking, when people bring a lawsuit, they are seeking money. What else can you sue for? Remorse? Sympathy? Admission of wrongdoing? When someone is financially compensated for a wrongful death or dismemberment, The underlying message is that money is the equal of life or limb. The technological program to make life safe, the conversion of life into money, and the perversion of the law converge into the realm of liability insurance. The very word insurance hints at the assumption that life can indeed be made secure, that the unsure can be made sure. One of the industry's own term for itself is, after all, risk management. The consequences of this assumption are far-reaching indeed. Have you ever wondered why all the fun playground equipment, really high swings, jungle gyms, and slides have disappeared? Liability. Why doesn't anyone allow skateboarding in their public areas? Liability. When the justification of safety is baldly absurd, liability serves in its place. For the last 20 or 30 years, deterrence has been the mainstay of our penal code and prison system. The assumption behind deterrence, implicit in the very definition of the word, is that without the penalties, people would commit the associated crimes. The law stands behind my innate depravity and your life, liberty, and property. Interestingly, this is what Thomas Hobbes was saying in that oft-quoted passage from Leviathan. It is instructive to read the whole paragraph. Quote, "Whatsoever, therefore, is consequent to a time of war, where every man is enemy to every man, the same consequent to the time wherein men live without other security than what their own strength and their own invention shall furnish them with all. In such condition, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and, which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Close quote. Hobbes was not talking so much about a pre-technological state, but rather the human condition in the absence of government. Without government, he argued, there could be no commerce, no buildings, no creative achievement, because what would stop someone else from just seizing the fruits of another's labor? We would always live in fear of robbery and would therefore be unwilling to do anything productive. Hobbes is talking about the ungoverned state of being. Because it is based on the Hobbesian Calvinistic precept of the innate depravity of man, law rests on a coercive basis that seeks to make socially undesirable behavior no longer in a person's rational self-interest. Law is more than codified social agreements, as in, we all agree to stop at red lights. It also includes explicit penalties for breaking those agreements. This is not just true of criminal law with its threats to life and liberty, but of civil law too, insofar as it seeks the enforcement of contracts. Think about that word. Law comes down to the application of force. But what else could we expect in a civilization so deeply invested in Newtonian principles? Force, after all, is the only way to influence a mass, or ultimately change the behavior of a person in the Newtonian universe. Inescapably, law, based on Hobbesian assumptions and coercive mechanisms, disrespects the citizen by assuming that coercion is even needed. Consider a trivial example. A sign that says, "No littering, $300 fine," versus a sign that says, "Keep America beautiful, please don't litter." The first almost implies that if it weren't for the fine, we would want to litter. The fine appears as the reason for not littering. The second comes across as a reminder based on the assumption that the reader certainly does want to keep America beautiful. or consider an agreement sealed by a handshake. Isn't it a disavowal of trust to insist as well on a financial penalty for breaking it, especially a penalty to be enforced by an outside authority? Is it really deterrence that prevented you from stealing this book from the store? Is your true nature that of wanton acquisition? Or is that kind of behavior the artificial product of the discrete and isolated self, and the painful response to the survival anxiety implemented through our economic and social institutions? Is that really us? Are you really a murderer, if not for the threat of the electric chair? If not, then the laws are insulting. The implicit insult of a deterrence-based or coercion-based legal system is really no different from the other means by which our culture corrals the human spirit and denies its innate goodness, divinity, and creativity. Really, the essential presumption of deterrence is, to use playground language, I'm going to make you do it. How do you make someone do something? By having power over them. And the ultimate power over someone is the power to threaten their survival. The threat to survival implicit in the policeman's gun is little different from that in a parent's shaming. The physical restraint of a jail is little different from that of a parent's superior physical strength. The fact that I am not afraid a policeman will shoot me is beside the point. The fear was internalized and integrated into concepts of propriety, practicality, and prudence long ago. For most people, the gun is just a little reminder of that, a token of an omnipresent threat to survival. It reminds us of the fear that is gonna make us do it. To reform the law along non-coercive lines would be impossible without reforming all the other structures of our society that arise from our conception of self and world. The Hobbesian Calvinist assumption of our inherent selfishness that underlies our legal system and logically necessitates deterrence is actually true, given the conception of self we have today. However, as our current misconception of the self crumbles, a new system of law will arise alongside a new system of economics, technology, and education. Its forerunners are already being tried out in various communities throughout the world. They do not require a society without specialization of labor, villages and tribes where everyone knows each other, but they do draw upon these social forms for inspiration. Such a system of law fosters community rather than short-circuiting it, respects ambiguity and the developmental function of conflict, and most importantly, assumes the goodness and not the depravity of all human beings. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
How many times do you have to ask? The answers never get you far. You're not sure of what your life is for, but you're doing all you can. What changes should you plan to make? And what difference would it make? If you look beyond your doubts and fears, happiness isn't far away. We don't have to be fantastic. We don't even have to be able to walk on the moon. We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself. What's the point of being gigantic? The world's too small. Why the need for domination? Can't we just be one nation? We won't have to live forever. Life of changing yourself. Sometimes pain can make us fall. What makes everyone so different? Can only be skin deep. What's the deal with being the only one? There's millions more just like you. Hold your head up and join the team. 'Cause happiness isn't far away. We don't have to be fantastic. We don't even have to be able to walk on the moon. We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself. What's the point of being gigantic? The world's too small. Why the need for domination? Can't we just be one nation? We won't have to live forever. You can write your life off changing yourself.
The war on germs. The same assumptions that shape our legal system also define our medical system. We have seen how the overarching paradigm of the discrete and separate self generates a technological program to control nature. In the case of law and education, the control is over human nature. In the case of medicine, it is over the body and its biological environment. In either case, the goal of this control is to achieve security and avoid suffering. The conception of ourselves as separate subjects in a world of discrete others implies that the interests of the self are fundamentally at odds with the interests of others. More for me is less for you. More for you is less for me. This fundamental ontology manifests in medicine as the germ theory of disease, and until we see ourselves in a different way, any other medical paradigm will remain marginal. The doomed program to eliminate all suffering by controlling the world takes a specific form in the continuing medical obsession with germs, or more precisely, pathogens, which generates a pathology. In other words, that which causes a disease. Bacteria and viruses are the prime culprits, to which we might add various fungi, prions, genetic mutations, and chemicals. To maintain the integrity of the separate self in a hostile world that would love to devour us for its own benefit, we exercise various forms of protection and control. Immunization against viral diseases, antibiotics, ponder on the meaning of that word, to destroy the invading bacteria, quarantines to protect us from contagious individuals, pasteurization to protect foods and beverages from germs, and other medicines to help us fight off disease. Apparently, this war on germs has been a great success. As all of the feared epidemic killers of the 19th century have been conquered. Actually, the ideology of the germ has greatly exaggerated the role of the two great weapons of modern medicine, the vaccine and the antibiotic, in the demise of infectious disease. According to Ivan Illich, quote, The combined death rate from scarlet fever, diphtheria, whooping cough, and measles among children up to 15 shows that nearly 90% of the total decline in mortality between 1860 and 1965 had occurred before the introduction of antibiotics and widespread immunization, close quote. Adult diseases such as cholera, tuberculosis, polio, and typhoid fever show a similar pattern, which can be attributed more to an improvement in living conditions than to medical advances. Nonetheless, medical propaganda would have us believe that the noble cause of modern medicine is to extend it to those backward parts of the globe still in thrall to such diseases. Meanwhile, in developed countries, we believe we can be even healthier by extending our vigilance with antibacterial soaps, flu vaccines, frequent medical checkups, and earlier screenings. The campaign of extermination against germs has some severe unanticipated consequences for our health. Killed off, along with the pathogenic microbes, are much of our beneficial intestinal flora, which interact with and modulate the immune system in complex ways that recent research is only starting to reveal. Moreover, our native bacteria protect us by monopolizing the intestinal surface to deny competitors a foothold. They even secrete bacteriocins and other chemicals that inhibit the growth of harmful species. As in nature, when the internal ecosystem is destroyed, opportunistic species proliferate, such as pathogenic yeasts and bacteria. We identify the cause of candidiasis as a species of yeast, but the real cause is a systemic disruption of body ecology. The same is true of our forests, where widespread tree death has also been blamed on various fungi. But why are the trees susceptible as never before? The reason is the same as in the body: systemic toxicity and the disruption of ecosystems. When antibiotics were first discovered, it was thought that bacterial disease was conquered forever. But like most wars to end all war, the battle against the bacteria has taken one unexpected turn after another. Bacteria have developed resistance to antibiotics with an alacrity far exceeding any expectation, and challenging indeed widespread scientific assumptions about the mechanisms of bacterial evolution. The response to the declining effectiveness of antibiotics is, you guessed it, more antibiotics. If technology seems to have caused a temporary decline in well-being, obviously the answer is more of it, more powerful antibiotics delivered in more potent ways. News articles speak of the arms race against the bacteria, in which heroic scientists race to expand the arsenal of new antibiotics before the bacteria develop resistance to the old ones. Meanwhile, just as with other examples of the technological fix, each new intensification of the technology exacts a heavier price, side effects such as candidiasis. The solution? More control, of course. Fungicides to kill the candida, and then other drugs to counteract the side effects of the primary drugs. Somehow we assume that someday a final solution will be developed that will once and for all resolve the original problem and the problems caused by its solution and the problems caused by their solution, and we will all live happily ever after. Indeed, there are scientists working today on just such a final solution. A class of antibiotics that are impervious to all known means of microbial resistance, an endeavor that Stephen Herod Buhner calls perhaps the most dangerous actions now occurring on Earth. The consequences of such a final solution would make candidiasis look like a walk in the park. Consider, for instance, that without bacteria, all life on Earth would probably perish. Imagine the consequences if herbivores lost the bacteria that allow them to digest cellulose, or if there were no bacteria to fix nitrogen in soil. After all, detectable residues of present-day antibiotics show up regularly and pervasively in groundwater, soil, and the tissues of living creatures. I hope none of these doomsday scenarios come to pass, but one thing is certain. The intensification of the war on the other can only have one result. Anything we do to the world, we do to ourselves. The reason is that we are not, in fact, discrete beings separate from the rest of life. The war on germs is but one aspect of our attempt to pretend otherwise, a pretense which, despite our increasingly strenuous efforts, is on the verge of collapse. Humanity has been compared to a cancer on the planet. A cancer is a tissue that has forgotten its proper function and continues to consume the body's resources even when its headlong growth threatens to kill the very body upon which its own survival depends. Can you think of a more accurate characterization of humanity's role on the planet Earth? Is it any wonder, then, that what we have done to the world is manifesting physically in our bodies? On the level of the individual as well, a part of ourselves exceeds its proper function and commandeers the resources of our entire organism. That part is a survival-based ego, which consumes the years and the vigor that should have gone into fulfilling our life purpose. Instead, life is devoted to the pursuit of the meaningless, trivial, and impermanent. All those things that give us a false sense of security, temporary comforts, and conditional self-acceptance. In other words, the psychic organ of self-aggrandizement, whose job it is to create a reasonable level of biological safety and comfort, has grown into a massive, all-consuming tumor. I think many cancers are the somatization of this self-betrayal. But how might we interpret disease and treat it, if not as an invasion? After all, viruses, bacteria, and cancer cells certainly seem to kill in very direct and obvious ways, and sometimes at least the allopathic treatments really do work. We kill the bug and the patient gets better. It is so tempting to think, if those cancer cells weren't there, I'd be fine now. If that candida were gone, I'd be fine now. If I could kill those HIV viruses, I'd be well. The pathogens seem obviously to be the source of the trouble. Get rid of them and the disease is gone. This way of thinking arises from fundamental tenets of Newtonian and Darwinian science, which envisions a generic universe devoid of purpose. The reason that pathogens invade is simply that they can. There is no purpose other than that. Our interests and theirs are fundamentally at odds. The universe is just like that, innumerable discrete beings competing for resources. What is it about one body that makes it susceptible to cancer, another to candida, and another to AIDS? Why do only half of study subjects catch colds when their nostril linings are swabbed with virulent rhinovirus cultures? For that matter, why does one section of the forest get overgrown with poison ivy, another with jewel weed, another with mustards? Why do the locusts swarm in certain times and places to defoliate every plant in sight? Thinking reductionistically, we generally ascribe these events to chance. I remember one cancer patient just diagnosed who desponded, "It looks like I just won the cancer lottery." Statistically speaking, a certain proportion of people get each disease. Will you be one of the unlucky ones? Statistically speaking, plant seeds disperse in a random way according to the variables of wind and other vector paths. Why did a thistle grow here and a burdock there and not vice versa? It was random, an accident, a chance. A scientific paradigm shift is rapidly rendering this idea obsolete. Chapter 6 describes how cooperation, symbiosis, and environmental purpose, alongside competition, are the defining forces of nature. Accordingly, we might consider the possibility that diseases too have their purpose, whether on a physical, genetic, or spiritual level. For example, many ancient medical traditions assert that colds and flu help clean out accumulated byproducts of toxic lifestyles. Recent research indicates that viruses convey genetic information to our cells. There is an alternative to the randomness of the locust plague, the burdock and thistle, the cancer lottery. What if the thistle seed sprouted here and the burdock there, because each had its own uniquely perfect contribution to make to the soil chemistry in that spot? What if the soil, knowing this, invited the seed to sprout and the seedling to grow by providing just the chemistry conducive to each plant? What if every being on earth has a contribution to make to the collective welfare of the whole? Are disease organisms an exception? Perhaps pathogenic viruses and bacteria actually have a positive effect on human beings, either individually or collectively. The paradigm of random infection plays into the program of social control. When we see germs as predators who seek to steal resources from us for their own biological interest, survival, and reproduction, then a rational response is to deny them those resources, to hide from the predators or fight them off, the fight or flight response. There is no necessary reason why one person rather than another should be the victim of the flu. If I believe, on the contrary, that there is some specific reason to my own body why the flu has infected me and not you, then the program of control doesn't make sense anymore. If my body is fertile ground for it, eventually the virus will get in and grow. Maybe the body does go through cycles of sickness and health, or of cleansing, rebuilding, and maintaining, that actually necessitate a head cold now and then, or that make it nearly unavoidable. Maybe diseases like colds and the flu serve some kind of eliminative function. Toxins being discharged along with the mucus, poisons incinerated in the heat of fever, bacteria invited in as scavengers to help eliminate the byproducts. Perhaps the body needs to go through some intensive house cleaning now and then. I remember reading one time in a medical advice column that it is a myth that people catch cold from getting wet and chilled. Viruses cause colds, the expert stated, attributing the myth to selective memory. We remember the times when a soaking was followed by a cold and fabricate a causal relationship. Contrarian that I am, I immediately knew that getting a chill does in fact cause colds. Probably what actually happens is that the chill creates an internal climate that is ideal for the virus, which proliferates and eventually causes symptoms through which the body eliminates the excess cold and damp energy, to use the nomenclature of traditional Chinese medicine, perhaps via mucus discharge. The cold and damp energy being gone, the virus no longer does so well and is rapidly eliminated by the immune system. We might look upon the virus then as an external organ of homeostasis. What happens if you scrupulously quarantine yourself from any contact with a cold virus? Well, the cold and damp internal climate persists indefinitely until one eventually gets in, or until something worse happens. As evidence for this conjecture, consider the simple fact that most people feel better after getting over a cold or flu than they did before they got sick. You would think they'd be weakened, but no, they often feel revitalized. Traditional Chinese medicine lends further support to this theory in the adage, quote, If you don't get little illnesses, someday you'll get a big one, close quote. If somehow the house cleaning functions of colds and flus are not allowed to operate, the toxins or energy imbalances build up and result in major illness. Perhaps it would be different in an absolutely pristine environment, but the toxicity of modern lifestyles and environment means that today, occasional illness is a sign of health. Provided that the symptoms aren't life-threatening, I let them fully express in my body. Cold and flu medications thwart the very purpose for which our bodies invite these germs. It is much better to support the process and give your body the resources it needs to see it through safely. What those resources are depends on the nature of the illness, and a qualified healer might help you figure out what they are, but invariably rest and quiet are required. Convalescing also gives us a chance to clean out psychic toxins along with physical ones, the stress, worries, and busyness of everyday life. If disease organisms have a mutually beneficial symbiosis with the human species, then the war on germs is grievously misguided. One of the main conceptual tools I develop in the next chapter is to see symbionts not as separate beings with whom we mutually depend, but as parts of self. The war on germs is therefore another aspect of our culture's self-other confusion, the confusion over who we are. It is not surprising that the great epidemics of our times are the autoimmune diseases. At its most basic, the immune system distinguishes between self and other. Our collective confusion over who we are manifests in the body as immune system disorders. Sometimes the causal link is quite specific. For example, the link between the increasing universality of childhood vaccinations and the rise in various immune disorders afflicting children. Best known is the link with autism, which can be understood as an autoimmune attack on the myelin in the brain. In my personal experience, the most striking is the enormous increase in the prevalence of allergies in children. When I was a child in the 1970s, we had one or two children in our class who were allergic to something or other, but it was fairly unusual. There were many fewer vaccines given then, especially in the first 2 years. Today, you hardly dare give a child anything to eat without first asking the parents what her allergies are. What about deadly killers such as cholera, typhus, smallpox, and the plague? It's not easy to see them as symbiotic friends of humankind, at least on the individual level. Nonetheless, these diseases might have a beneficial function on an ecological, genetic, or spiritual level. In any event, deadly acute epidemic diseases are mostly a thing of the past. Much public health energy is expended preparing for the next epidemic, as authorities raise the specter of terrorist-propagated smallpox, a new virulent influenza epidemic, something exotic like Ebola, or a new disease like SARS. In focusing on these, we are fighting the last war with the weapons of the last war. These are the sorts of enemies against which the technologies of control, vaccine, antibiotics, quarantine, etc., are effective. The new diseases of the modern era are of a different sort. Cancer, arthritis, chronic fatigue syndrome, Alzheimer's disease, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, AIDS, and so on defy the medicine of control, which has made almost no progress in curing them, despite research outlays dwarfing those of the vaccine antibiotic era. Significantly, most if not all of these new diseases involve a dysfunction of the immune system, They reflect the same self-other confusion that defines our relationship to the world. Helpless against the diseases of the 21st century, we instead take ever more extreme measures against the microbial world. One of the manifestations of the war on germs is the proliferation of antibacterial soaps, latex gloves for all food service workers, and strap-on mouth guards that appeared, and in some cases were legally mandated, during the Asian SARS epidemic. These devices constitute a physical barrier between self and world, concretizing the psychological distance that separates us from each other and from nature. Sometimes I have nightmare visions of a future where the very idea of breathing each other's unfiltered air is repulsive and illegal, where everyone wears a gas mask and all human contact is mediated through latex or computer terminals. Equally frightening is the current hysteria about avian flu. Since it is spread by wild birds to poultry flocks, some officials are implementing new controls prohibiting chickens from ranging free. Yet it is caged indoor hens with their debilitated immune systems that are the most susceptible, and it is factory methods of poultry production that actually spread the disease. A related proposal in the United States is to mandate that a digital tag be embedded under the skin of all livestock. Everywhere, the technologies of control are the same: separation, confinement, and the numbering of all things. As long as their ideological underpinnings remain intact, none of these trends will abate. Already, medical microchips are available that can be embedded under human skin to monitor various physiological states. In Asia during SARS, body temperature readings were taken as a condition for entering certain public facilities. Potential epidemics offer a rationale for the quarantine of populations and control over their movements, an internal passport system justified on medical pretexts. All such measures make perfect sense from the mindset of separation and control. Our phobia of germs is a specific form of a more general aversion that goes by the name of cleanliness, the quintessential manifestation of the urge to control. Cleanliness is next to godliness, it is said, but that is true only if God is remote from this earth. What is dirt, but quite literally, the world? To maintain absolutely clean bodies and clean houses is to separate ourselves from the world. There are few faux pas so serious as showing up filthy and smelly to a social occasion. To be one with the dirt is to be uncivilized, to be less ascended from the earthy world, to be more of the body and less of the mind or spirit. Similar considerations explain why adults feel so uncomfortable when they are sticky. As any parent knows, young children don't mind being sticky at all. But to be sticky literally means that the world, the other, adheres to yourself. Stickiness, therefore, violates our sense of control by threatening the physical separation of self and world. A final and very telling aspect of the war on germs is the insistence on the absolute sterility of the food supply. The pasteurization of milk, beer, and other products has as much to do with uniformity and shelf life as it does with safety, which is more a rationalization than a reason. Reinforcing the economic motivations of uniformity, shelf life, and standardization is the more fundamental motivation of control.